Strap yourself in,
because we're set up, switched on, and ready to go.
Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear. The clock has started.
This week's episode of our podcast. Today we are going to interview some of the greatest and most influential minds in our field. By sharing our collective expertise, we will show you how to harness, control, and use your own skill set to achieve ultimate success and live the life you want. And now, please welcome your host.
Welcome to this week's Smallest Cast Podcast. This podcast is designed for the small government contractors, service providers, and manufacturers as part of the government contractor ecosystem, connecting people, organizations, and resources. I'm your host, Just Nate, and this week we've got Chris England sitting here across the table from me, like at least 12 feet away. Welcome, Chris.
Well, hey there. I'm glad you punched the buttons so that they could hear me.
I did. I looked down and it was red. So let me make sure I've got our guest here pushed so we can bring our guest online here too. So Chris, today we've got on the phone with us Mr. Russ Long, who's the founder and CEO of Long Capture. Welcome, Russ.
Hey, thanks so much for the opportunity. It's great to be here.
So unfortunately, we do not have our lustrous CEO, Mr. Dennis Cater, here with us.
Our fearless leader.
He had to go get some medications. I told him.
He's like, just making words up, aren't you?
That's right, making words up. It's kind of funny. He's like, Nate, I'm sorry, but I got to go. I got to get this. And I'm like, dude, don't worry about it. Go get your crazy meds, and then we'll take care of the rest.
We got you covered.
So Russ, you're making waves in Colorado Springs here, man. We talked briefly before. You're rocking it right now. So kind of walk us through. First of all, let's get a 2-minute overview of what Long Capture is and what you guys do.
Yeah. So like you said, I'm here in Colorado Springs. What first brought me out was the Air Force Academy. I came from Oklahoma and just really enjoyed the mountains. So my wife and I decided after I got out, we'd move back here. But I was a contracting officer in the Air Force while I was active duty for about 5.5 years. And just saw, you know, there's a ton of opportunity for small businesses to work with the government. Obviously, you guys know, like, this is a place a lot of people are a bit more familiar with it. But it's just a very confusing and convoluted system, you know, to start working with the government. So taking the skill set I got from the Air Force, hopped out and started Long Capture about 3.5 years ago at this point as I separated. So what we do... very briefly, like where we're at today, we work with a lot of different tech startups, many of which are commercially focused. So they're primarily servicing, you know, the private sector, Fortune 500 companies, whoever, out in the commercial sector, working with really cool, you know, leading edge technology. And they have some interest in working with the federal government, Department of Defense, especially the Air Force. You know, we have a lot of work with them. And so we help them, you know, find some different points of entry. Small Business Innovation Research, SBIR, is one of our favorite tools in our toolkit. We can dive into that later. But we help them through this process of, you know, understanding how to work with the Air Force and Department of Defense, how to put in solid proposals, win some work, build those relationships, and go on to win bigger and better contracts from there. So that's kind of like our core business, I'd say. We also are actually on our own contract with the Air Force to support a lot of the different software factories and innovation hubs, a lot of these innovation efforts that the Air Force is trying to do. So that's been a blast. Basically, we are trying to be that connective bridge between industry and what the government's trying to do, like these innovative pushes. Because as you probably know or have experienced, you know, in your own careers, they speak very different languages. So a lot of times stuff gets lost in the translation. Industry doesn't know where to get started, how to get funding, you know, what are the next steps? So we try and bridge that gap through that contract. So there you go. There you have it. Hopefully that was the short enough version.
No, that was awesome, Russ. So we've got a lot done back here. So first of all, I'm full of questions here. I'm writing a couple notes. One question is, you said you're a contracting officer. So a lot of people that might be listening in might be just starting up. Were you considered a KO, a CO, or PKO contracting officer?
CO in the Air Force, and then I think Army calls them KOs. The COs for them, I think, a commanding officer.
KO in the Navy as well.
See, when I was working Air Force contracts, I was always knowing them as KO or PKO because I'd always ask people. Matter of fact, I used to work for a very large government contractor, and they would always say, "We got to talk with PKO. We got to talk PKO." I always thought it was like somebody's initials. I'm like, "Who the hell is this PKO guy? And why do you keep saying we got to talk to him? I've never met PKO. Who is PKO?"
He's Patrick, the contracting officer.
So I want to get that out there for people to understand that, you know, it might be any one of those three things. I think when you're listening to government contracting, I don't want somebody to make the same mistake I did.
Yeah, when I finished up, I finished my short career there in the Air Force at Space and Missile Systems Center, and their contracting at the time I take it back. It was PK. I'm just getting lost in the weeds. Forget about it. I'm just going to go with what you said.
Correct. Well, the reason why
I was PK, but it was ADK. And, oh man.
The reason why I asked that is because these guys here at work we've all had that conversation multiple times now. They're like, no, it's CO. No, it's KO. What? Which is it? I don't know. It's like they can't standardize on something.
Yeah.
So. You know, I've sat in on several of these interviews now, and
it's a podcast, not an interview.
Interview, podcast, call it what you want.
It's a conversation.
It's a conversation. We're just talking to the guy, all right? No, we have seen quite a few, and we've had the opportunity to talk with several companies that were at the very kind of infancy of getting into government contracting. What have been some of the biggest lessons learned you've seen and you've helped, you know, clients get over in getting into, you know, where to start, you know, who do they talk to? How do they learn the unique language of government contracting?
Oh man.
That's an easy question, right?
just off the top of your head.
Okay, we want you to talk, but we don't want you talking for 20 minutes by yourself. So take a breath so we can interject our two cents into it.
No, I know left and right boundaries. So let's see. You know, I think some of the very basic entry points are like with PTAC. I think they're great for registrations, kind of getting that initial, and they have some educational resources as well. So like very early on, like taking first steps, getting SAM registration and stuff like that done, I think they can be very helpful. And figuring out like the women-owned certification and veteran-owned and all those pieces. Beyond that, like it's really hard. there's not a whole lot of resources. And, you know, an effort, like I've been very purposeful in our efforts through LinkedIn and our company page and our website to like put out, have webinars open to the public, put out resources. Like we have our own SAM registration guide to just walk companies through that's for free on our website. But just put out stuff like that to kind of get the ball rolling with these different companies. Because, it's just tough, especially if you're an early, really early stage company that can't spend a little bit to get like consulting support or pull in an expert or hire, you know, as an employee, someone with a little bit of experience. It's a maze. So honestly, like that's why we're doing what we're doing. Cause it's so unclear and convoluted. And even like once you get your foot in the door and you start winning those contracts, there's compliance issues and invoicing and a lot of other hurdles, that, you know, companies just need to make sure they understand what they've committed to, so they don't, you know, end up hurting themselves or hurting their financial situation because of a government contract. So is that what you're looking for?
Yeah,
that absolutely. So, well, we've had everybody from, you know, technology folks, cyber kind of folks. We've had, you know, folks that concentrate on infrastructure, which are very, I mean, you know, in the contracting world, very different contracting vehicles. They're managed differently. And I just, you know, that this is very enlightening. I'm glad that, I'm glad we had you on, 'cause you seem to be a great bridge between, you know, those companies that want to break into government contracting and those that already are and are kind of doing it and, you know, learning lessons, you know, kind of on a daily basis, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll say, like, our approach, 'cause you guys, again, anyone that's a little bit familiar with acquisitions knows that competition is a huge piece of everything that they do. And so the reason I brought up SBIR as one of the avenues, because if they can get in and get at least a phase one, then they have that sole source ability. So, like, our whole approach is, I don't want to go and compete with the, you know, 10 or 15 of our best friends against, you know, some contract. I want to get this ability to go and do sole source contracts. So I try to approach the game a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
But there's many different avenues to get started.
Well, so I think
I would just
go ahead.
One word of warning, you know, something I see a lot of companies do is, like, spend a bunch of money to jump on that GSA schedule. And while that can lead to some opportunities, what most don't understand is that just kind of, you're spending a lot of money just to get your foot in the door. There's no real guarantee that you're going to get contracts at that point. So, you know, it can be the right strategy for companies. I'm not trying to totally bash that approach. It's just companies, you know, I encourage them to take a bit of time, do some research, try and understand, you know, if you spend the money or you take months and months to, like, get on something like that, like, what does it actually look like afterwards? Like, once you're actually on that schedule or on that contract?
Yeah. I think I've always told, 'cause obviously, we here at the Smalls, we talk with tons of small businesses and with, you know, asking questions of how did we get our start? Where do we start? I highly recommend to most companies to start by subbing to somebody else, right? Don't try to go after that $100 million contract, your very first contract, because more than likely you're not going to get it. You're just going to waste a whole bunch of time and
money. Out. Yeah. And money.
Yeah. So you also mentioned PTAC. That is by far probably the first place we push people as well. If you haven't gotten into PTAC to help get your SAM, your DUNS, your NAICS codes, all that kind of stuff chosen, get down there. It's all free. Why wouldn't you do that, right? For a small business, that's like the best word in the whole world is free. So
absolutely.
So
yeah.
So do you guys offer help on proposal writing, or do you guys offer classes on proposal writing, all the above? What do you guys offer?
Yeah. So the way we work with most of our clients at this point is we do some one-off proposals where we're doing the writing or reviews for them. But our core model and what we're trying to do is actually work with companies that have a bit of traction already. So they've started, you know, with the technology, they have a couple commercial customers, or they have some venture capital backing, and they want to really grow and scale quickly within the Air Force and Department of Defense. So the model is, like, we're working with them month to month. My goal is to work with them anywhere from a year to a year and a half to go through, like I said, kind of this SBIR entry point, or maybe another transaction, but start there. Get that sole source authority, and then work on developing relationships, finding different program offices and end users. You know, who's the warfighter that's actually going to use that technology? And so long story short, is we help write the proposal, try and do the heavy lifting on that, because you guys know it can be truly just frustrating and mind-boggling.
No.
And then once you have the win... And then once they actually have the win, you know, develop those relationships, find the right place to plug in their technology, and build that strategy and execute to move on to larger sole source contract awards.
Well, I think one of the things you mentioned that kind of went by the wayside there for a second is, what did you sign up for? That is like the number one issue I see most small businesses make their mistake, especially when they first get into contracting, government contracting, is, hey, we won this contract. What do I need to do? Well, you signed all the paperwork and you hopefully have read through it at least 2-3 times before.
Read the fine print.
Oh, and there's a lot of it.
Yes, and, exactly. And I think that can be daunting, right? Especially you're a small business. You probably don't even have enough money to have a attorney on the payroll, which is a catch-22 because you kind of need one for all of this paperwork, but at the same time, how do you afford one?
How do you afford don't have the contract one? Yeah, exactly.
Did you ever have an issue where you were walking through with a contractor and they didn't know what they signed up for, Russ?
Yes, unfortunately. So we're primarily dealing with like firm fixed price contracts or other transactions. But even so, like what they've promised in their milestone delivery, you know, they just have to be careful with that piece. So as an entrepreneur, I am guilty of this, but many of us are overly optimistic about what the future, like what we can accomplish in a short amount of time, you know?
Well, so yeah.
When that gets incorporated into a contract, that's where it can become an issue. So when you're building those milestones of like what you're going to hit, what you're going to deliver, keeping in mind some very realistic, you know, milestones and goals for you to hit, because those are often tied to your payment terms. So yes, unfortunately, that we've seen it a couple times, and you know, we can go back to the contracting team or the technical team and say like, hey, can we tweak this a little bit? And go from there.
Yeah, I think a lot of times some of the government customers, they especially if you're just getting into it, hopefully they'll be willing to work with you a little bit on that if you didn't realize something in a certain scenario. But I've also worked for large contractors where we got a new brand new contract, firm fixed price, but it was performance based payment milestones under a firm fixed price contract. So you know, each one of these types of contracts has their own set of rules and regulations as well. So for example, maybe we said this particular one was maybe a $30 million job and we had like 100 performance-based payment milestones. They actually put them on contract. Wow. But right afterwards, the government came back to us, said the contracting officer, the KO, said, wait a second. No, we can't do this. This is way too many. It's going to be too much paperwork for us. Well, we had already developed our entire accounting system around that. So,
and your delivery schedule.
And delivery schedule. So we had to go back to the drawing board. We came up with around 30-some performance payment milestones. However, I will say we also got in trouble because we went to go and bill for those. And like the third one, they came to us and said, well, what is this payment milestone? It's like $100,000. Okay, so we delivered you a white paper, for example, right? It was on the schedule. By this time, we were going to have a white paper delivered, and the government would have owed us $100,000 for delivery of that milestone. DCMA got involved, the auditors, and came and said, well, that's fine, but wait a second. You have to prove to us you spent $100,000 to be able to get paid that $100,000. We're like, what are you talking about? Nowhere, that's firm fixed price.
No. Not on the firm. Yeah,
exactly.
Not.
But the powers that be, we actually had to readjust everything and kind of, if you will, let them peek up the skirt on that scenario, because which is number one no-no for anybody doing contracting, firm fixed price. They should not have view into any of your books, because that's the whole point. That's why you take on all the risk, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's why you take the risk. Yeah.
So I caution people, don't always just let them say, well, this is what we need, because sometimes the contracting officer might not know how that contract should be ran either. So that's where I think a company like yours can come in handy. Because if I was a small business and didn't have lawyers or something like that, I could hire to say, hey, Russ, so this just happened to me. Should I let them look at the books? And your answer would probably be absolutely not.
Yeah. And then we can dig up some FAR language and throw it at them. just to back up our case, you know?
I like that.
Unfortunately, so we do see stuff like that all the time where, yeah, they're asking for things and it's like, no. Like you shouldn't be.
They can ask.
You shouldn't be asking for stuff.
That's what I used to tell them all the time, because it would always scope creep, right? Because especially if you got a customer that's used to mm-hmm. doing cost plus types of contracts and, mm-hmm. and, you know, they'll come to you and say, hey, Nate, I need you to now build me a half rack that does this XYZ. And typically I would say, cool, we can do that for you. We just have to cost it in whatever and slap our overhead rates on it and we're done. Well, firm fixed price, you have to stand up and say, I would love to do that, but it needs to go through contracts. So then we can price it and schedule it and add that scope to this current contract. 9 out of 10 times, that is the right answer, but it's also the answer that they don't want to hear.
Mm-hmm. So what's the difference in the contracting types? I mean, I'll ask the dumb question. Why would you go firm fixed over cost plus?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you from working on industry side, you know, they're flexible, they move fast. And you have to go through all these audits and you have a very strict accounting system in order to go cost reimbursable type contract vehicles. And I'll tell you, like, it can be good in more risky environments, maybe like research and development, if you're doing like really big $100 million, $500 million contracts. Because they will reimburse you for what's called allowable cost. So the government will reimburse you for costs under this contract. So there's really not a whole lot of risk there as long as you're performing or attempting to perform and along the scope of work. But you get a smaller profit typically because the government is bearing more of the risk under this type of contract vehicle. So for my clients that want to move fast and break things and have different models like software as a service that government is not used to dealing with or, you know, buying from, it would just be an absolute nightmare and really bog them down to go through all these auditing processes to get ready for cost reimbursable type contracts.
So how does that differ from like OTAs? I mean, you hear that thrown around in meetings and I still don't know what it means.
Yeah, it's okay. Most people don't. And that includes like the government folks that are using it. So OTs, other transactions, it is wide open. The purpose of that is to negotiate on basically commercial terms. So like if we were to do business in some way in the private sector, we just negotiate our own terms of our agreement. So as you kind of got at earlier, and all these federal acquisition regulation based contracts, FAR based contracts, you just have pages and pages of clauses. These are the terms and conditions that get lumped into your contract. So it's just, it's outrageous, all of these different rules and regs that get thrown into a $20,000 purchase order. You know, like the poor guys that would come on base and like mow the lawns, like you're throwing a 60 page contract at them with all these outrageous terms and conditions because you have to.
Just to mow the grass.
I've got a quick story about that, but before I do that, we're going to take a quick break and listen to a sponsor real quick. We'll be right back. This podcast is brought to you by CHAFA, the Colorado Housing and Finance Authority. Since 1974, CHAFA has strengthened Colorado by investing in community development and affordable housing. CHAFA's community development team partners with lenders across the state to offer the financing you need to grow your business. Talk to your local lender about CHAFA's Cash Collateral Support Program, which helps small and medium-sized businesses access capital that would otherwise be unavailable due to collateral shortfalls. To learn more, visit chfainfo.com. Welcome back to this week's Smallest Gas Podcast. This week on the phone, we have Mr. Russ Long, who is the founder and CEO of Long Capture. Welcome back, Russ.
Hey.
So before break, you were walking us through why some would go firm fixed price, others would be cost plus, reimbursable, the different types of contracts. And I had mentioned that I have a quick story about that. And mm-hmm. The story you kind of started off with was these poor guys that are doing, you know, mowing the lawns on Peterson Air Force Base or on an Air Force Base or on a base anywhere. And then they have like a 60 pages worth of TNM or something like that, or sorry, TNC, terms and conditions that they have to abide by. Well, I was a young man once, and I was doing this contract where I had to get power from one building to the next because I was building a brand new facility. This is on the East Coast. I had a weekly meeting with the commander on base. It was an 06, and not necessarily the nicest 06. He was very... didn't really like contractors, right? He had that, there was this aura between us. And I've never been military myself, so I had my own aura of whatever, right? So I remember we had to break ground in between two facilities, and it was like literally like a 3 foot wide trench. We had to put in a bulkhead, or IFL, what we would call it, inner facility link between the two facilities to get power from one area to the next. Finished the job. I seated it. I had the contractor seat it, whatever. And in the middle of that seating, right, after I got it then seated, I went to my, about a month later, after the grass started growing, we were watering it every day, I went to the commanding officer on base and said, hey, so I noticed your guys have been going around that area when they're mowing. Can you please just have them mow over it now that the grass is growing? Otherwise, if you don't, it's going to start growing weeds, right? That's just kind of the nature of grass. And his answer to me...
Landscaping 101.
Yeah, his answer to me was very much a absolutely not. And I was like, why not? And his answer was, well, that's not turned over yet. You still have another 24 months on the contract. You need to take care of that. And I'm like... Really? It's like 200 feet long, 3 feet wide. You can't, it's like less than one pass with the lawnmower. You're having your guys spend more time going around it than it would be just to go over it.
So you're telling me you owned a piece of grass for 24 months.
For 24 months, I had to hire a 16-year-old kid to come out, get a clearance, you know, extra paperwork to get on base, to mow this thing. Yep. They had to give a guard because this was a 24/7 facility, and it was on an internal area where they had to have a guard watching this kid mow the lawn, and he literally did it with a push mower every single week. I kid you not, I also had the commander come out, take a look at it after we had it, started having him mow it, and by now our relationship wasn't the best. Because
you think?
Because of little things like this. And I was like, so does it look okay to your standard now as we're getting ready to turn over? And this is like 6 months before turnover. I just want to make sure it's good in case I had to redo it. And he looks at me, and I kid you not, the straightest face, he looks at me, he's like, how many blades of grass per square inch are there? I started laughing at him. I felt bad. I'm a farm boy, right? I literally laughed at his face, and I'm like, sir, I don't get paid enough to do that. Get on my hands and knees, count blades of grass. That did not go over well. He was not happy. He's like, we have a site beautification plan that says I need to have at least 112 blades of grass per square inch on anything that's replanted. I'm like, this guy's serious. So when you say 60 pages of documents, read those documents, because it's little things like that that's going to bite you in the rear.
Because that's how you're going to own a small piece of grass.
Apparently. So that's my little quick story about my grass story and hiring people to do jobs on
that
base.
That was pretty good, Nate. Hey, Russ, I have an additional question.
Before you go into that, Russ had a comment there. What's up, Russ?
Oh, I was bringing it full circle, Nate. So coming back to, I think what led us down this path to the grass.
Squirrel. Squirrel.
Other transactions. So it's just a much more flexible vehicle. So like the 60 page regulations, all that stuff. No, it's totally negotiable. It's supposed to be commercial terms that you can put into these agreements. Now in practice, that's a different story. So we can go that way, or I totally get into the question if you want to jump into them.
So are there different contracting vehicles based upon, you know, whether it's a R&D project, or whether it's a mow the grass project, or whether it's a dig a hole project? Do you see different types of contracting vehicles?
Yeah, let's not go too into the weeds. Yes, depending on it, there's a bunch of different avenues. But just top level, it's, you know, your cost reimbursable, firm fixed price, and there's variations on those. But then the other transactions, which, like I said, is completely negotiable.
And then I think, so most of the jobs I've done when I first started my career in the DoD contracting side was cost plus fixed fee or cost plus, there's just different types of fees you can get. But from there, I moved into firm fixed price contracting, which personally I actually liked because it drove, it was much more black and white the way it should be, right? On a firm fixed price project, I've got a contract and I GPC bound my contract, and that contract was usually maybe 200 pages. I literally carried that contract everywhere I went, and people would kind of make fun of me. They're like, why are you doing that, Nate? I'm like, well, as a lead, I need to know what's in my contract because this is firm fixed price. And how I bound that, kind of what we were talking about, risk and stuff. So how you bind that as a contractor is making sure that you have assumptions. So assumptions are the opposite of risk, right? If you take on all the work, most of the time on a firm fixed price, that's the contractor. They take on more risk, but that's why the reward is greater if you can finish, you know,
ahead of schedule, under budget, whatever.
Now, you don't want to tell them that you're making 25% profit because that'll probably be the last time you get that type of contract. Next time they're going to negotiate a lot harder. But I think what I've noticed is just be very, very adamant when you're doing your proposal. Make sure that you've got assumptions in there. For example, I assume that after I get my grass planted, the government on-site mowing company is going to take over mowing this on 60 days after I plant grass, whatever. You make those assumptions, and that now puts the risk back on the government to make sure that
to account for
those types of things. Otherwise, if you don't do that, it's going to be the little things that bite you in the rear on firm fixed price. But we got pretty good at it. I will admit that we were pretty good making sure that we balance risk and assumptions. To us on a firm fixed price, risk was mainly an opportunity. So if we found other things in there during proposal, we would throw that as an opportunity to say, hey, we just noticed this. Would you like us to add this into the contract? And by doing that, that turned it into an opportunity for us and took that risk away. And now we had additional work and different additional funds.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, sorry, I kind of took your thunder there, Russ.
What I'll say is, I mean, all of those reasons and like all these stories are reasons I like to, like, I want to see more other transactions, like type agreements happen. And we are seeing some, especially from the Air Force, and hope to see, you know, other DoD branches start doing that as well. Because, I mean, these commercial companies, again, they're leading edge technology companies. They're working with really big corporations or private companies, and they don't have time to comb through a 60-page contract to look for gotchas, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just like a totally different approach, which I think is, if done correctly, can bring the DoD up to kind of more modern practices.
Well, and like you said, you're working with some of the innovation centers or software factories, stuff like that. That's kind of the government's first step, what I'm seeing, into the real commercial side of things. I can tell that they're still a little uneasy about it, but I'm now starting to see them trying to embrace it a little bit more. Unfortunately, I still see scenarios where people create a brand new software factory. The government's like, oh, great, here's an OTA, here's money, let's move forward. But then all of a sudden, you start seeing after about a year of operating that way and it's going very well, they start saying, well, this is so good, we now need to put a few processes around it to make sure that we can repeat this same this very same thing. Well, now what are you doing? Now you're just making it another government.
Like everything else.
Like everything else. So it's going to take forever to do again. So I think what you're seeing right now is that pendulum swing from one end to the other.
Well, Russ, do you see trends in contracting? I guess it kind of ebbs and flows like everything, but I mean, is there, I mean, discernible trends within the contracting world?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So two examples off the top of my head. So 2.5 years ago, I think we're approaching 3 years, Air Force, you know, stood up AppWorks, and AppWorks approached the SBR program and said, hey, we're going to do open topics. So instead of having 100 or 150 very, very specific and difficult, you know, like very specific to certain programs and certain problems and certain technologies, it was very hard to kind of find that entry point. So they broadened the scope. They allowed to do these open topics where you come and tell me what your technology is and where you think it can fit. So they just can't, they can't write a problem statement or requirement for every problem the Air Force has. There's all kinds of technologies they're unaware of. Industry's moving faster. There's way more investment going out in the private sector, because it used to be that the Department of Defense was leading the way with research and development spending. But now that has flipped tremendously. So private sector has a lot of great innovations that the DoD is not taking advantage of. So that went from being like one topic out of 150 was this open model. And then it went to about this time last year being the only way that they were doing this Air Force SBIR topic. I'll give you one more example. Other transactions, there's very little guidance and rules, at least at the statutory level, like written into law around how to do other transactions. It's extremely flexible. That's the point. What we see is one person takes a little bit of a risk and they do like the consortium model, right? You know, they get a consortia person and they bring in a bunch of relationships from industry and universities and large prime. And then instead of trying new and different ways or different approaches, everyone just is like, well, they did that and they didn't go to jail, so I'm going to copy paste and just do that over and over again. So now they're everywhere, you know, and I think there's definitely room to improve that model as well. But yeah, like in my opinion, the way the rules around other transactions are written, I can get two people going out to Starbucks, have a coffee, they can pitch me and I'll pitch one. And that satisfies all the requirements necessary.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know about you, Russ. We've seen a lot of OTAs coming out lately. I caution people on spending a ton of money on going after these, because what I've seen, at least in the past 12 months anyway, on these OTAs is you may win an OTA, but like 80% of them are unfunded OTAs.
Yeah. Okay. So similar to my example earlier, like doing your homework. So paying the money to go get on a GSA schedule. And that all that means is that now you're just sitting on a schedule somewhere, and if someone actually knows how to use GSA schedules, it is a little bit easier to get to you. Same thing with this consortium model. You pay a couple $100 or a couple thousand, depending on, you know, who you're working with, who's running it, and what size you are, a couple other factors. But all that does is just get you in the club. You know, it's your club membership. It doesn't mean anyone's going to do business with you. And honestly, like I see it as like, if you have a customer, like if you have a program or someone that wants to spend money on you, you know, taking that funding to someone like DIU or to these consortia, whatever it is, taking that money there and using it as a different type of contract vehicle, trying to tie this all together. So it's just a different flavor. It should be more streamlined and flexible. But yeah, so in my opinion, I think that a lot of the quote unquote requirements coming out through this consortium model, they probably have been talking to industry, have someone in mind, you know, and a very strong opinion kind of differing from that on the traditional federal acquisition process. But I do think that's what we see a lot in consortiums.
Yeah.
So,
I don't think that's a bad idea. Like, you pay your,
yeah, I don't either, honestly. Like, if you can get a couple of different, if they can be open-minded to a couple of different approaches, and sometimes they'll fund multiple prototypes to just kind of test them out, and then select one or two to go to production, really probably just one. But companies, you know, they might join a bunch of these different, you know, pay the membership fees and jump in and think that they're going to get a bunch of business opportunity, and there's not a whole lot depending on which one you join.
Well, and one of my favorite sayings over the past 5 years was General Raymond, when he said, we need to learn how to fail again. And
yeah,
I think that that's what's driving some of these OTAs and some of these other transactions, because a traditional IDIQ / DOTO, or which is a task order, delivery order.
What did you just say?
For
any of the alphabet soup that just came out of your face.
So any of the other types of contracts out there, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, IDIQ.
Oh, there we go.
And then underneath the IDIQ, you have either TOs, which is task orders, or delivery orders for something larger, DOs. They could take upwards to a year to from the time they release an RFP to the time they pick somebody. Where an OTA could be, write me a white paper, and then it takes 300 people down to 10 people, and then they say, okay, give me a presentation, and then they pick somebody after a presentation. So it might take 2 months to give a $100 million contract that way. So I think as far as trying to move quicker, I think it's a good idea for a lot of these different types of contracts that you're seeing.
Yeah.
So I think they're moving the right direction. And especially for some type like prototyping things, that we need to learn that you don't have to get it right every single time, right? Learn to fail to fail quicker.
Learn to fail fast. Yep.
So Russ, real quick. So you had said, for you, you guys do lots of different things. You said, people can hire you to help out with all the different things we've talked about today. But I'm curious, how do you guys, what's your guys' business model? Do you guys, are you guys firm fixed price for contractors? Do you guys do T&M? You said you want to spend a year, year and a half with companies to help them out. What type of contracts do you guys do?
Yeah. So this agreement where we're working with them long-term, we have a monthly fee and then we get 5% of the contract award as well. So the reason for that is I try and bring a pretty robust team. People have experience in contracting and doing sole source contracts and negotiating all this junk that goes into it, writing all the proposals, you know? So the monthly fees kind of cover my business costs, but I don't make any money. Honestly, I don't make a profit until they actually win and I get that percentage of the award. So to me, I'm doing my best to align my incentives with our clients. And again, that's why I want this longer term relationship, because, you know, I don't want to just win a $50,000 contract and say goodbye, that was fun. I want to go after the $5 or $10 or $15 million contract. But it takes time.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, to build those relationships and to set up that contract vehicle.
So 5% of the, is it of the contract value or the 5% of the contract profit that the prime wins?
Contract value.
Okay.
And again, so in a competitive environment, that wouldn't work, you know, because you're going to make 5, 7, 10%
profit, I was going to say, you know? Max of 8.5% usually.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so yeah, it's got to be all of that only applies to a sole source environment where we're going in, we're negotiating. A lot of times it's kind of around research and development and delivering some prototypes or making some tweaks. So, you know, we help them to make sure they're presenting a, you know, reasonable cost, but they can still make some sort of margin that's at least comparable to what they're doing in the commercial sector as well.
So
that's the thing, like if you want like these leading edge technologies that are making 30 to 50% margins or higher in the commercial sector, and you're going to tell them to come to the DoD where they can make 7%, and by the way, you need to be CNMC compliant and you need to do these equal opportunity reports and you need to turn in like X, Y, and Z, you know, like, so anyways,
why would anybody do that? Right.
Point. Why would anybody sign up for that? Right.
No, but that's the age old battle. I can't tell you how many PKO guys, gals that I've had that conversation with, where they present to me, once we go into negotiations, they present their little form. I don't remember what it was off the top of my head anymore, but where they say, well, by this form, we figured that this contract with this much risk, you should make a max of 8.9% profit, which I know that most commercial companies out there, you guys probably are thinking, that's insane. Why would we ever do something like that? It costs us more than that to keep the lights on. So, but that is government contracting. So that's why I think a lot of people are now moving towards more of the firm fixed price. so you don't have to have open books on everything. Yeah. But I'm curious, when you, so you have monthly fee plus 5% of the contract price. Are mm-hmm. you, do you stay with them throughout the contract then? Do you provide a body, consultant body, or how do you work that?
Yeah, so we have a team. We have a capture strategist. They're the ones building the strategy. Like, hey, here's how we're going to get to, like, the phase two and then, like, the sole source phase three. You know, that's the goal at the end of the rainbow that we're going to go after.
So they're
building that strategy, and we have a proposal support coordinator as well that does the heavy lifting on the proposals. Okay. As long as they're working with us, you know, because they can terminate currently at any time. So we're trying to always make sure we're doing work that, you know, I don't want people to sign up for like a year and be stuck with us and not like to work with us. So our agreements are currently you can terminate at any time, just giving 30 days notice. So we, to me, you know, the reason for that is like, we're always trying to show and add value to these folks as they go through this process. You know, I don't want there to be a 2 or 3 month lull where they're looking around and like, why are we stuck with these people?
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, you know,
well, that makes sense. But
yeah, that's kind of our approach. So as long as they're still working with us, yeah, we'll help with some of these compliance pieces, invoicing especially is always a nightmare, things like that.
So I think one of the things your primary customer then base would probably be people with product, right? Not necessarily, I don't know, I'm guessing you probably don't help out a lot of companies that are doing ANAS or butts and seats type contracts.
Correct. Yeah, this is, so it's mostly like technology
companies. Okay.
We have a new technology. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense then, because butts and seats or CETA or ANAS, which is advisory and assistant services, you know, that's typically just, we need 100 people to be engineers and do the work for us, right, as opposed to selling a product like you would for an SBIR, STDR.
Mm-hmm.
So, exactly. Russ, how do people get a hold of you? I mean, we've talked a lot today. We've kind of wet the whistle, hopefully, of our listening community. How you said you have a website?
Yeah, website. You can reach us through there. Our sales@longcapture.com, email. I'm very active on LinkedIn and our company page as well, so you can reach out through any of those two pages. And again, just like, we're putting out blogs multiple times per month. We're trying to do webinars around but the monthly time frame to get information out about these programs, but to try and give freely and get information out to help companies kind of weigh these decisions.
So did you say what was the website?
Oh, longcapture.com.
Longcapture.
LONGCAPTURE.com.
There you go. Hey, that works perfect. You should record that for us, and then we'll, you know, we can start putting you on the radio here with us. This is great. And then I'm going to go check your website out again. I know Dennis and I, we've been watching your guys' stuff for a while. And we'd like to try to help you guys out too by putting your events or whatever you guys are trying to push on your website. We can definitely link to ours as well to try to get more broad range to help get whatever you guys are doing out there. And just try to help the entire ecosystem, this entire, what we call Earth, right? Trying to help each other out here. It's kind of,
sure. I very much appreciate that. And I totally, you know, I guess I had thought of you guys because we used to always do all these in-person events around town. But yeah, obviously a lot of folks are doing virtual stuff. So yeah, we'll send that over. And we have some resources on the website for free, like going to that SAM registration.
Nice.
So we have guides with pretty pictures and snap screenshots and stuff. So it should be very user friendly, hopefully.
Nice.
We'll always open to feedback, but
we'll definitely help you guys out there and try to, we can even link you guys to our website as well, as a partner to part of this entire ecosystem. You know, I was just having before you called in, I was just having a conversation with Dennis that, you know what we haven't had on the podcast yet. Now hear me out. Is somebody from a big chain hotel branch. And Dennis looks at me, he's like, dude, what are you talking about? Why would we ever bring? I'm like, are they not part of the ecosystem? When you travel for a government contract, you must usually stay within per diem rates. And you know what? If you don't develop that relationship, hotels don't care. you go out to an island someplace, they're like, it's $600 a night. And so you got to develop those relationships. They're part of the ecosystem as well. So, and that's the same way I look
totally agree.
The same way I look at you guys, Russ, is you guys are part of the entire ecosystem, right? You guys have a role to play. And I think that's why we wanted you guys on the show. And we want to help push your brand and name out there.
Well, thank you. I very much appreciate it.
So anything else you can leave our listeners with there, Russ?
Oh, man, I should have had some golden nugget to leave everyone with. No, hey, again, just appreciate the time and the opportunity to come on and share a bit about what we're doing.
Well, I think,
and I hope folks found it informative.
I think the golden nugget, Russ, is to go to longcapture.com and take a look to see what Russ can do for you.
Exactly. Thanks. Hey, thanks again.
You're a better sales guy than I am.
Thanks again, Russ, for answering all my questions today. I tried to play the dumb question guy. The
cool guy? You failed.
Well, Nate, you've been really good at throwing out acronym soup all for the last hour. So I tried to as much as possible.
Yeah,
to keep him grounded, get to speak English now and again.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch.
That's
right. Sprechen Sie Contracting.
Okay, Russ. Well, I do appreciate you coming on with us today. And we will make sure we stay in touch. Let's keep in touch for a follow-up. Once we go back in person, we'll probably like to have you be one of our speakers at our in-person events once we start doing those monthly again after the world gets back to normal.
Oh, yeah.
I refuse to say the new normal. It's going to be normal. And so if you will, Russ, stay online real quick. And for the rest of you guys listening out there in podcast world, this is Just Nate signing off. See you next week.
Thanks for listening.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Smalls Cast podcast. Connect with us at thesmalls.org. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to receive our free materials. See you at the next episode.
See you at the next episode.